Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to call the Subcommittee on Fish and Wildlife to order. Today is Monday, March 9th. Folks, we have a pretty full and ambitious agenda before us today, so we'd like to get started with Senate File 982. Senator Eakin, if you could approach the testifiers table. Welcome to the Subcommittee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and member, I guess.
We're expecting the Subcommittee to fill out here in the coming minutes.
Yes. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill deals with deer hunting seasons and the angling season, the angling openers. It was brought to me, an idea brought to me by a constituent who was looking for a way to encourage more people to get involved in hunting and in fishing and to get them to maybe come a little bit further out to greater Minnesota. And maybe stay a little bit longer and maybe spend a little bit more. And so his suggestion was that we move the opening of the hunting season and the angling season up by 12 hours from midnight on Friday night to noon on Friday. And again, the hope is that that's going to generate more hunting and fishing activity. People could take a three-day weekend. And that's the whole reason that this is being proposed. We definitely need to encourage, I think, more people, young people in particular, to get involved in the outdoors. This was one way that he thought we could accomplish that or help to accomplish that.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Senator Eakin. Do you have any testifiers or anybody in the audience would like to speak for or against the bill at this time?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please approach the testifiers table, and if you don't mind stating your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Corey Bennett, representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. I have had a chance to speak with Senator Eakin on this bill just this week. And although MDHA does not have an official position on this bill, I would like to raise some concerns that I think we kind of foresee if this was to go forward. As I can see, it's kind of beneficial for some, including those that have businesses and things like that and maybe are local to the area. We have over approximately 500,000 deer hunters in the state of Minnesota. A lot of those hunters travel. They plan their vacations around this time of the year. In those circumstances where those individuals have to travel, certainly I think we're going to have to see people take off an extra day of work. If they don't have to take off on an extra day of work, they're probably taking their kids out of school a day early. We also have people that are working a five-hour work week that would find it, I think, difficult to change their plans at this time. And so, there are some things that we would have some concerns about. The current season does allow people to all start at the same time, gives people time to travel to their destinations, where their hunting lands are, get their kids out of school, maybe not having to take them out of school, those sorts of things. So as I can see, it's beneficial for some. I do think it would be a hindrance to others. And for those reasons, Mr. Chairman, although we do not have a position on this bill, we do have concerns with moving the deer season at this point.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Bennett. Any other testimony from anyone in the room today? We'll be hearing from DNR. If you don't mind stating your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. And in our testimony and concerns, we have talked with the author about it, emulate much of Mr. Bennett's there. It's not a biological or a population type issue, though there is some concerns about, we're talking about catch and release bass fishing this year and things like that, how that would be impacted by this. But it's more the tradition. It's, how do people get out of school and get up north and things like that on a Thursday rather than Friday afternoon, Friday night for the deer opener? It is a huge traveling day for people. As much as I like to get out of town before noon as soon as possible, but
not always
at the fishing
possible,
opener,
right?
The number of boats traveling up north, just, a lot of people set up family traditions based upon those types of things, and that's our only concern, Mr. Chair.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Meyer. Appreciate hearing this. And Sarah, we do try to strike the right balance between managing populations in Minnesota and other people's schedules, perhaps, but also promoting hunting and fishing and trapping opportunities throughout the state. So as we do with all bills before this committee, we'll plan on laying this on the table for possible, laying this over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill, which members in the audience were expecting to move on that bill this Wednesday. So all bills before you today will be laid over for possible inclusion in that omnibus bill.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chair, and
Senator Eden, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did talk to Mr. Meyer and Mr. Bennett earlier, we had a nice discussion, and I think it's a good discussion to have. And I know that tradition is important, and certainly Mr. Meyer had referred to that, Mr. Bennett as well. But I think, traditions can change, too, of course. And in a few years, new traditions could emerge. And there is no biological reason, as Mr. Meyer said. It's just the tradition issue, and I'm certainly sensitive to that and willing to visit with them and others as we move forward. So thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Eakin. We appreciate that. If there's no other discussion or questions at this time, we will lay Senate File 982 over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
All right. Up next, we have Senate File 1348. Senator Ingebrigtsen. Senator, welcome back to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you very much for hearing the bill before you, Senate File 1348. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 1348 is pretty straightforward. As you can see, it's just about a line and a half change in addition and legislation. And basically what it means, and I do have a constituent with me today by the name of Mike Hannon from Otter Tail County. He's an avid bear hunter. He brought this issue to me a couple of years ago. Last year, as you remember, we talked about it on the floor. We also talked about you giving me a hearing this year to bring it up for more discussion, and that's what we're here to do. But basically, as you can see in bear hunting, you have an opportunity to be able to use the trail system in the state of Minnesota. And what we're asking today is pretty straightforward, just asking to add the month of August onto the statute. So I think with that, I'll probably turn it over, if I could, Mr. Chair, to Mr. Hannon from Otter Tail County. Let him give a little description of what he goes through as bear hunting and how he expects this request to actually move forward, if that's okay.
Very well. Mr. Hannon, welcome to the committee. If you don't mind stating your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Mike Hannon. I live near Fergus Falls, Minnesota. I've hunted and fished in Minnesota since I was young enough that my father had to carry me along. I began bear hunting in 1984. And, back in those days, I was substantially younger than I am today. But by the same token, as things progressed through the years, we began to see use of ATVs and that be used to allow us to get our stands and bait sites further back into the woods. And early on, essentially, if you stayed on a state trail, all was good. I don't know exactly. I was asking Bob Meyer earlier if he could recall exactly when it changed, but probably somewhere around 10 years ago, it changed to where some forests, state forests, were classified as managed, some were limited, and some were closed. And a number of those areas where there's trails and roads and stuff through the state forests, you now couldn't use to access the forest areas. Maybe an unintended consequence of that is a lot of the counties adopted the state's rules in their managed forests. And so for individuals like me that typically would use our ATV to drive on the trail to get close to our bait site and then, park our four-wheelers and carry our bait and stands and everything into our site, we now either had to choose to walk that, and like a lot of our sites will be 2.5 miles off a road. As I get older, I'm not likely to do that. So I did approach Senator Ingebrigtsen last year and just said, in the hunter's handbook, there's a little section that's called hunter and trapper exception that allows some use of those trails and roads for hunting during the hunting season. It starts the way that's in the handbook is the months of October, November, and December are included. Unfortunately for us, our season starts September 1st, and actually our baiting season starts the middle of August. So we're a little bit exempted from that hunter and trapper exception. And I thought it was as simple as just say, let's change the language. And I have met with Senator Ingebrigtsen and some of the folks from the DNR, and it isn't really that simple because what I'm asking for is to make sure that we can use those established trails and roadways to get back into the forest. If if you just added the August and September to the way that it's written in the handbook, my understanding is that would open it to cross-country travel, and that's certainly not what we're asking to do. So I think the way that the bill is written here today, it would be clear that we're asking to be able to use those trails for an extended period of time, but not travel off trail into the state forest. And as a aside, probably also those counties that have adopted the state rules in their forest lands.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Heenan.
Thank you.
Sorry, Ingebrigtsen.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically what we're asking for is to be able to utilize the trails, not go off the trail, which I know was a concern last year and always has been a concern and should be because, you know, being a four-wheeler myself, if I'm on a trail and I see somebody veer off the trail on a previous date, I'm probably not going to do that, but some are apt to just follow that trail, and pretty soon you have a considerable amount of damage going on to something that somebody probably was, you know, basically abusing the system. So that's not our intent at all. Of course, our intent is always to encourage young hunters as well as to keep the older Minnesotans in the deer and bear stands and keep them hunting in Minnesota. So this is one of the areas where we'd be able to encourage them to continue to be able to bait a little bit longer, a little bit earlier. So,
okay. All right. Well, thank you, Senator. Any question or discussion among the committee members? Any additional testimony in the room at this point?
Mr. Chair, if I could, I think the DNR would like to weigh in on this, if that's all right.
I'm waiting for them to approach.
Okay. Very good.
All right. Welcome, sir, if you don't mind stating your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Craig Schmid. I'm the Deputy Director of the Forestry Division, DNR. Relatively recent addition. I've been a deputy director for 2 years. Before that, I spent 25 years working mostly in northern Minnesota, all north of Highway 2. So I remember back in about 2000 when we started the OHV planning process. It was actually quite a fun job. We got a Trimble GPS, we got on an ATV, and we rode every trail in our forestry area. So we had a base map to start with. I think it was 500 or 600 miles of trail in the forestry area that I worked in at the time. It was a lot of fun. But I wanted to refresh everybody's memory a little bit of history of where we came from starting in 2000, and I handed out a map. If you look at that map, the brown line down the middle is Highway 2. There was a little bit of difference in direction between State Forest south of Highway 2 and State Forest north of Highway 2. South of Highway 2, basically in classification, you had two options. It was either to be limited or it was to be closed. And north of Highway 2, you had the full set of options, which is managed, limited, and closed. The idea being that south of Highway 2 is a little closer to population centers. There was more ATV activity taking place in those forests, and to some extent there are a little more environmental concerns there. So this change really only affects what you see on the map as yellow. It doesn't affect the green in a significant way at all. Because of that, I just wanted to kind of express that this whole OHV management thing is really a system. You know, there's a lot to it. There's managed, there's limited, there's closed, there's areas with limitations inside those forests. And recently in Pine County, we went through a trail revision process where we looked at the state forests in the county and did some reclassifications. And our thoughts are that with this change, it kind of changes the mix a little bit. And as we go through those processes, state forest by state forest, there's a wide suite of interest in this, from people that don't support ATV activity at all to those that are recreational riders to the hunting public that have a bit of a different dimension. And so as we go through those state forests, it potentially could have an effect on what that looks like. There could be more areas with limitations. There could be more pressure for closed forests. What that looks like, obviously, is the outcome of the process, but that is the dynamic that is there. It is somewhat confusing. You know, there's a large matrix of what's out there, and now an additional exemption may add to that a little bit. But all in all, we think it'll shake itself out as we go through that process, and the correct thing will happen on the land, but it will change the picture.
And if you don't mind just standing for a question here, it's a difficult question probably to answer, but how pervasive is the problem out there of individuals utilizing ATVs or off-road vehicles and essentially creating their own trails or doing damage to our trail system or natural habitat? Any sense as to what the DNR is seeing in that realm?
Well, like I said, I've observed that for ever since we got into this process, and I will say that it's gotten significantly better. You know, ATV users, I think, have heard the message that there's potential damage to be caused out there and they need to view the land a little bit differently. They've had public campaigns and I think made a great deal of difference. There certainly still are trouble spots out there that we occasionally post close and limit traffic where rutting or damage to wetlands or streams occurs, not as prevalent as it was 6 or 7 years ago.
Sure. Okay, well, thank you. Senator Engelbert.
Mr. Chair, and I apologize for not coming prepared here with numbers. I may pose a question with regards to your question as to how many ATV bear hunters we actually do have. I don't know if they have a sense of the numbers. We did talk before the meeting. There's some bear hunters, of course, that don't use ATVs. So there's a number of tags that go out every year. I'm not sure how many of them actually use ATV for baiting. I don't have those numbers. I don't know if the DNR has those or not.
Okay. Perhaps we can get our hands on those numbers down the road. And certainly appreciate that the map here, this is very interesting, brings the issue to life for us here. Any other questions or additional testimony from folks in the audience today?
Yes,
sir. Please proceed, Mr. Heenan.
Thank you. If I might add something there. In the existing language and the existing exemption, it clarifies that those that are using the trails during that time of year have to have a valid hunting license. And one of the discussion points that I've made over the period of time would be that if this was expanded to include August and September, you know, definitely we would want to see that. And additionally, as bear hunters, we register our sites. So we send into the DNR each site that we're hunting and register it with them. So I've kind of made the, I don't want to say argument, but the discussion point that, you know, we're almost the easiest people in the woods to track down because we tell them who we are and where we're at, and we put our signs on our sites and that type of thing. So I don't know if that plays into the decision-making process, but it certainly should as far as I'm concerned.
Sure. No, we appreciate hearing that. And, you know, we're trying to put our finger on sound policy that balances, you know, various interests here. And we appreciate you bringing this issue to our subcommittee this year, Senator Ingebrigtsen. And I know we discussed the matter last year, and hopefully we're able to arrive at a good path forward here. Any additional comments, questions, testimony in the room? Well, as with other bills, we'll plan on laying this over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. So thank you, folks, for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
You stay there. You're
gonna go. I'm just going to stay. All right. And members, up next, we're kind of bifurcating our agenda here today. We have a number of bills at the front end and then a lot dealing with trapping regulations towards the end. So I have a bill that I've brought to the subcommittee here, Senate File 1549, that deals with an issue in southeastern Minnesota. Contrary to what we heard last week from DNR, we actually have a lot of deer in southeastern Minnesota. And so I'm going to have Mr. Knopf just briefly overview the bill for us real quick, and then we have some testimony from folks from southeastern Minnesota this afternoon. So, Mr. Knopf, if you don't mind, just a brief overview of Senate File 1549.
Mr. Chair and members, 1549 creates a pilot program in the Series 300 area, which is southeastern Minnesota, and it doesn't expire, excuse me, in 2020, so it would be a five-year pilot. And with the first part, it has a couple of parts to it. The first part would allow a landowner with at least 80 acres and who suffered some damage. Now there's an empty dollar amount in the bill that would have to be filled in at some point in the process, but it would have some threshold as the damage that they suffer from deer to their crops, and then they would be eligible for up to five licenses from the DNR to take deer, and they could actually pass those on to other individuals to take the deer on their property, and the deer could only be taken on their property. We have a similar program for a landowner that's in statute, but it's for one, and it has to do with only certain areas where there are additional doe permits under the current law. What this does is provide a pilot program that's outside of that and provides those additional five licenses. So that's the first part of the bill. It also says that those that there's going to be a program in place where to match landowners to deer hunters in this area, where the landowners who are suffering the damage could be put on a website sponsored by DNR where deer hunters could access, and you'll see that in paragraph C on the second page, would provide them for those experiencing damage to kind of match up with hunters, but it does say that only those with advanced hunter education certification will be eligible for the program. So you're going to ensure that these are the best trained hunters that we have in the state. Would be eligible to use the website to contact the individual farmers. One thing I want to make sure in paragraph B on 1.21, that if for those additional licenses, we'll go back to that for just for a second, that they must allow public deer hunting on their land during the deer hunting season, with exception of the first Saturday and Sunday. In other words, to be eligible for those additional licenses. That's pretty standard language. It doesn't mean that you have to open it to the general public, but you do have to allow the public onto your property who maybe come to your door and ask, that sort of thing. And so that's basically the bill. I don't have any questions on how it works.
Well, thank you, Mr. Knopf, for sharing that with us. And as I had mentioned, there a lot of difficulty in certain parts of southeastern Minnesota with crop loss or just over a bunch of deer populations. So we're trying to craft an approach here that brings hunters who are looking for deer together, perhaps in the metro area or elsewhere, with landowners who are looking to maybe thin the herd or get rid of some deer that are causing damage to their crops, for instance. So this pilot program is outlined in Senate File 1549. We've asked a member of the Farm Bureau in southeastern Minnesota in Winona County to come forward and provide a little testimony today. So, Mr. Marg, if you don't mind stating your name for the record, and we've got a few moments here, so if you don't mind keeping your remarks fairly brief.
Okay. My name's Robert Marg. I'm Winona County Farm Bureau Vice President. I've worked deer issues for Farm Bureau since 2005. The issue for me started, though, way back in 92 when I quit running state land because we were having so much damage we couldn't make a profit on it. I've also talked to somebody from Senate, and I believe it's called Nonpartisan Research, that has stated that this has been a problem for 30 years. The DNR has also stated at a meeting in February a year ago in St. Charles, they said, well, you're our guinea pigs in this area. And then they announced that there's $3 million worth of crop damage. Well, we got a lot of farmers, young farmers, trying to start out. And with $3 million of crop damage, a lot of them are taking $10,000, $15,000 hits, which at this time the farmers can't take. We're going to lose farmers down there if something don't happen with the deer population. As far as the bill that you got wrote here, most of it I had wrote up on something I had turned into Senator Schmidt here. It's got a lot other stuff on it. My bill gave a choice license, not just a deer license, as one of the licenses, because if the farmers are going to take $500, $600 damage, I believe they should deserve at least to have the choice if they want to shoot a big buck if it comes by. It doesn't manage the herd as much, but right now they're catering to trophy hunters with the antler point restriction, which we were told at the time was a doe management tool. And I've gotten the kill numbers, which state that actually there was a drop of 15% in the deer kill when they started this program. And they told us there were 30% more doe shot the first year. Senator Miller actually called that meeting in Winona, and I just talked to him, and he said yes, he remembers that. And when the third year, they said there was such a big party of people that wanted this so bad in southeast Minnesota. Well, I've talked to over 220 hunters that don't want that. I've also talked to an awful lot of landowners that don't want it. And I've talked to somebody from Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, and I believe what their wording was something like, well, we took a vote on it, and there were three people in favor of it and 267 opposed to it. So, you know, if it's so, you know, great and everything, why are so many hunters opposed to it? But getting back to the bill that you have here, a few changes that I'd like to see. Number one would be that the hunter, the farmer, could get a choice license because I believe he deserves it. Because my son-in-law said for $410, he can get a lifetime license. And to ask for one choice license for having, in my case, I have about $1,500 damage a year, I don't think is that big a thing. And the doe license that are asked for are to help control the doe population that I had asked for in mine. The 80 acres is something that also came up to me as a problem because I work with a lot of Hmongs. I sold over 100 pigs to the Hmongs for years. Every year I'd sell over 100 pigs to them. They're coming to me now because they know I was working on this deer issue, and they are talking that, well, they have big gardens. Sometimes they supply 10, 15 families with these gardens, and the deer are coming and destroying half their garden or more. And so they also should be able to get licensed for this. Some of the apple orchard people have come to me and says, well, they told me I'm supposed to put up a fence around it, but the expense of the fence, well, the DNR will put $3,000 into it, but some of the people said they got $20,000, $25,000 to put in it after that yet. So some of the smaller orchards, 40 acres or whatever, should be able to get in on this too. At the point where you have the dollar amount blank, from the people I talked to, from deer hunters to farmers, have said that they figure the first $500 the farmers or the people could eat. So that's the figure that I'd like to see put in there. As far as the second part of it with the thing, with the website, we've asked for that several times already. You were at the meeting, I believe, up at Wilson Fire Hall. We asked for it there, and we were told that Farm Bureau should do it. Well, Farm Bureau doesn't have nation or statewide anything that would accommodate this, and we do believe it's the DNR's job to be managing the deer herd. Now, as far as the antler point restriction, we'd actually like to see that put in here as canceled because it's not working the way they said it was going to work. We've got Farmers Union and Farm Bureau, and I believe the gentlemen, the lobbyists, are both here. They could speak on it if they want to, that we oppose antler point restrictions. And with what I believe the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association have stated, that makes quite a group against antler point restrictions. And since it's a program that is not working and the DNR ended up putting 10 doe limits on Houston County and southern Winona County, it kind of shows that it's not working and there's too many deer. So that's basic points I'd like to make.
Well, Mr. Mark, we really appreciate your testimony today, and if there's no questions among committee members at this stage, we would ask for anybody in the audience who would like to speak to this bill, please approach the witness or the testifiers table. Well, thank you, sir. If you don't mind stating your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Steve Merchant. I'm the Minnesota DNR's Wildlife Population and Regulations Manager. We have an existing program in southeastern Minnesota that basically accomplishes exactly what this program is attempting to do. We have been working on it for 3 years, so we have a lot of the administrative issues resolved, and we're likely to take this program statewide next year. So we have some concerns of going back and sort of reiterating or duplicating the program that we already have in place. We feel that the program that we have in place has fewer limitations on the landowner. Landowners that have serious depredation issues can actually get up to a maximum of 75 tags that they could use, depending on the situation. We have no acreage limitation. And we don't have any existing dollar amount or any litmus test on how much damage must occur other than they just need to have significant damage and work with us. I'm concerned that the DNR is not, we're not experienced in appraising crop damage. I mean, we know when crop damage occurs. We can see it. We are not appraisers. So I think that we have a program in place that's currently working. We began this program in 2012. We had 9 participating landowners that year. In 2013, we had 12 participating landowners that and their selected hunters on their land shot 230 deer off of those depredation permits. 2014, we had six landowners and their selected hunters that were able to shoot 75 deer. In addition to this, the Minnesota DNR annually distributes deer shooting permits, many of which are given in the southeast. For instance, last year we issued 20 farmers were issued shooting permits in the southeast where 127 deer were removed. So we believe that we have a program in place that's working just fine.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Merchant. Any
Mr.
questions?
Mr. Chairman, may I?
In brief, you sure can, Mr. Marg.
Okay. Number one, their shooting permits, they have so many rules on them. You can only shoot the deer if they're out in your fields. You have to have the hunters' names ahead of time, which if they can't come for some reason or another, you can't put somebody else in, which I think it should be able to. The farmer should be able to decide how many and who they want on their land as long as they sign it in and give it to the DNR at the end if they who got deer. The other problem is giving the shooting tags. They say, yes, you have 25 shooting tags or 30 shooting tags. They'll give you 10. And the problem that I've come across on several farms is that, yes, you get the 10. It takes a week to get them. You get them filled that weekend. You call on Monday and ask for more, and they say it's 7 to 10 days to get the next bunch. So, therefore, it seems to be a stall tactic so they can't, the hunters actually can't shoot the deer that they say that they should be able to. And I do have one guy that did shoot 59 deer on his place under shooting tags, okay. But he had 109 deer supposedly on his place, according to the DNR. So it works on some farms, but it's not for the population we have down there. It don't work.
Okay. Well, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Marg. If there's no questions, any other testimony in the audience today for or against this bill on this issue? Well, as we have with other bills today, we will be laying Senate file 1549 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Thank you, Mr. Marg, for your testimony. We appreciate hearing that today. So Senate file 1549 has been laid over for possible inclusion. Up next, we have Senate file 774. I saw Senator Johnson sneak in here earlier. Welcome to the subcommittee.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here. Members, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of interesting. We're talking at one point where there's too many deer, and then we turn around and start talking about how to protect them. The bill that I have, Senate File 774, was brought to me by my constituent, Gerald Hansen, who is sitting next to me. He's a member of the Minnesota Trail Hound Association. And also Kevin Gustafson will also be coming up here. Members, you can see this is a quite simple bill. As you know, what we're doing here is just allowing only peace officers or conservation officers who observe a dog wounding, killing, or pursuing in a manner that endangers big game, that they may be the only people who would be allowed to kill a dog if they determine that that is happening. What we're doing is not allowing just regular citizens to kill a dog if they see it. And the reason I'm bringing this up is this. First of all, I'll start saying that this current statute is very vague. It doesn't specify what a dog who is pursuing in a manner that endangers big game is actually doing. It will help by restricting the ability to shoot a dog to a peace officer or a conservation officer. We can prevent unnecessary canine death. Currently, DNR policy requires officers to have physical evidence that a dog was chasing game in order to shoot them. A member of the public who is not required to inform the DNR or anyone else when they kill a dog that may or may not be chasing a deer. Conservation officers are also able to subdue a dog using non-lethal methods if they are found chasing game in order to return the dog to the owner and fine them for not properly training the dog. Members, this is not really an issue that I have spent a lot of time working on in my years in the legislature, but it is one that I care about. I do believe that many, many people have very valuable dogs and are very, very emotionally and physically attached to those animals. I don't think a dog should be shot just because someone thinks they may be endangering a deer. I know there is a great concern on the part of the deer hunters against this bill. But I ask that really, I think the deer are being killed by animals that, in fact, some of these trail hound people who are using their dogs for hunting coyote and fox are actually helping to maintain that the coyote would be one that would be likely to kill more deer than a dog would kill. And I would hope that you would give us a chance to convince you that this is the right thing to do, Mr. Chair and members. And with that, I'll ask Mr. Hansen to speak if it's okay with you.
Well, thank you, Senator Johnson. It's great to have you in our subcommittee today, and thanks for those remarks. Mr. Hansen, if you'd like to state your name for the record and proceed with your comments.
I'm Gerald Hansen, a member of the Trailhound Association. I own American foxhounds that I use on coyotes. And I got to thank Alice for doing such a nice job, but she didn't give me much more to speak about. One of the problems we have is that the general public is not really familiar with our sport and what the dogs do. These are long-range hunting dogs, which means that that when I turn it loose in a patch, it will travel quite a ways to find a coyote, and in that amount of time, it will go possibly by many deer. And then it will run a coyote, and it doesn't bring it back. It just runs it, and it's for me to get in front of that chase to take the picture or shoot or whatever. So it's entirely different than a bird dog man that's walking right behind his dog. So I'm not there physically saying, yep, here I am, here's my dog. The dog is out there, it's doing its thing. I run a GPS tracking system on the dog, so I know where he's at. I also have other people, forward observers, that are out there, and I also run an e-collar on him. So if he is doing something wrong, it's not I can stop him as soon as I'm aware that he is doing something wrong. The problem we're having is the dog's safety isn't dependent on if he's doing anything wrong. It's depending on the amount of exposure he gets to the public, because the public minds have been poisoned that dogs out in the woods are bad. So I guess what I'm saying is we can't run them during deer season. And then after deer season, January comes around, and now it's institutionalized dog shooting season. And the public is just not aware of how it works. Our people, I've talked to members of hunting clubs that take 150 coyotes a year. My estimate is we take about 2,000 per year. And these coyotes will not be feeding on fawns in May because they're just not around. They won't have a litter. They'll be just gone. So if say, each coyote is average 4 or 5 coyotes or fawns a year, I mean, you're getting into 8,000 to 10,000 fawns that are saved by us being out here. We also are hunting... primarily we're hunting when there's snow. It's an aid to us. We can look for tracks. We can send a dog in where there is a coyote. We got a track. We get into cold weather and there's not so many trappers out there. I'm not against trapping, but if a dog does get in a trap, there's possible damage to the foot. Plus, there's a lot of us that are construction workers. Gets cold. There's less work. You have more time to be out in the field. It's also a constitutional issue. I mean, when the general public shoots a dog for allegedly chasing deer, it is just allegedly chasing deer. There's no proof at that time that the dog is chasing deer. The dog could be running through a lot of deer, and the deer are moving away from him. that doesn't constitute chasing deer. When my hound is chasing deer, he's on that scent. He's putting ground behind him. He's on that deer scent. He's tracking that deer. He's not just going through the woods and the deer are getting out away from him. He's pursuing that animal. General public may not have that definition. What I'm saying is a lot of the general public aren't qualified to make that decision. And it's not because they're stupid. It's just because they haven't been trained in that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Hansen.
Could I have Kevin speak next?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yes, if you'd like to state your name for the record and proceed.
Hello. I'm Kevin Gustafson from Stansfield, Minnesota. I, too, run hounds like Jerry does. But I'd like to focus mostly on the January 1st, the way the law is written. That gives the public, they think they have the right to shoot a dog, and they can get away with that. All they have to do is say he was chasing deer. There's no proof, and they just use that date for an escape code. So I would like to see a change where only an officer could do away with the dog, or if the public has absolute proof, say there's snow on the ground, they can call a warden or an officer, and if he can't make it an hour, he can make it the next day. The snow won't lie. The tracks will be there if a deer is killed by a dog. But that law was written, I believe, in 85. We had a lot of snow in them years, and I believe that's what it was written for. Because of the deep snow, the dogs could catch and kill. And but anyway, that's what all I get to say is.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate that. Yeah, Mr. Hansen, if you'd like to add on.
I'd just like to make one more comment. Even if a person's dog isn't shot, the threat is always over the head of the person who is out there with his pooch. I was hunting with Kevin's dad quite a few years ago, and a man was walking down the road with a .22 going to where the coyote was going to cross, and Bill's dog was coming towards him, and his dad sent him home because the man said he's going to shoot the dog because there were deer out in the woods. And that particular dog was an old, experienced dog. He was faithful. I mean, if he barked, he was on coyotes. The man was going to shoot the dog because he was out there. Another time, I was threatened that somebody was going to shoot my dog, and that dog was faithful. I mean, that's all she ran, and I knew that. But the owner of the land, which we had permission from, was excited because he'd seen deer run. Well, the deer were getting out of the way, but that didn't mean that Molly wasn't running a coyote.
Sure.
So, thank you.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. You brought this issue to life here for the subcommittee. We appreciate that. And we also appreciate you bringing the issue to the subcommittee, Senator Johnson. With that said, are there any questions or comments around the table? Any additional testimony in the audience today? And Mr. Bennett, if you'd like to approach, if you can make some room for him. Yep. Well, go ahead, gentlemen. And again, if you don't mind stating your name for the record and proceeding.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Corey Bennett, representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. Mr. Chairman, this is one of the bills that a couple of weeks ago our corporate board had a chance to review and did come to the conclusion that we would like to oppose this bill, Mr. Chairman, as we have done last year, I believe. This is the second year that it's been introduced, and a couple of different occasions I've had a chance to talk with Senator Johnson about our concerns. Mr. Chairman, this bill does delete a important in parts of the season or that deer are very vulnerable. And I want to point out, we are talking between January 1st and July 14th. I think there's this perception that dogs are being shot year-round by hunters out in the woods. If they're doing that right now, Mr. Chairman, it's illegal. The only time a person in the woods that can discharge a firearm with a dog pursuing big game is between January 1st and July 14th. And there's good reason for that. It's a very vulnerable time for deer. Maybe not this year, but in past years when snow depths, they're very deep. If deer are chased, they tend to fall through the snow. They don't run on top of the snow. They tend to fall through the snow and leave them very vulnerable.
years like we have right now, when we probably don't have as much snow cover, even the pursuit can be detrimental to their fat stores and how they're going to be healthy through the winter. It's also a time when does are actually carrying fawns, and if they're chased hard enough and they overheat to a certain extent, they will lose those fawns, or the possibility is that they will lose those fawns. So that's a concern. Also, Mr. Chairman, as you'll see in the bill, we're removing the provisions and the times in the spring. Those are typically the times when, obviously, does are birthing or dropping their fawns, leaving them very vulnerable if pursued. Certainly, we don't want to see the doe chased away from the fawn, and if, in fact, they do, that fawn can be at jeopardy. And so, Mr. Chairman, we respectfully oppose this legislation, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Sir, if you'd like to state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Slocum. I'm from White Bear Lake. And I'd like to testify on behalf of this bill, SF-774. Agreed, we don't want dogs chasing wildlife. I think everybody agrees on that. The question is, will people follow procedure? There is a proper procedure to be followed if a dog is chasing wildlife. And we can count on law enforcement to follow that procedure. I don't believe that we can always count on citizens to follow that procedure. And that's why I support this bill. Thank you.
Well, thank you, sir. Appreciate your testimony. If there's no other additional, if folks would like to step up to the microphone, you can say some more words. And, sir, again, if you'd like to just restate your name.
Gerald Hansen.
Yes, please.
The person from the Deer Hunters Association said that you couldn't shoot a dog at this time. It's past January 1st and not July. This is the time that a person could shoot a dog for allegedly chasing deer. Getting back to there's other hunting seasons that are after January 1st, and a lot of these dog owners cannot hunt during deer season. So if the deer hunters don't want us to do it during deer season and they don't want us to do it after deer season, there's no part of the year left.
All right. Well, thank you for adding that. Members, we do have a lot on our agenda here. So what we'll do with the Senate File 774, if there's no further discussion, is lay it over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you, Senator Johnson.
Thank you, members.
All right, up next we have Senate File 591, Senator Wieger. And I should just add, we've received a lot of correspondence and written testimony regarding the next four bills we have on our agenda. I know that these issues do evoke some emotions among folks, and we do want to try to provide for a respectful conversation on these issues today. I just remind folks that we're not acting on any of these bills today. We'll simply lay these bills over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. We do want to try to put our finger on some good sound policy here, and that's why we're having this discussion. So with that said, Senator Wieger, welcome to our subcommittee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, subcommittee members. Senate File 591, one sentence, appeals to common sense and fundamental right of a private property owner. That is, if a person is to go on one's private land and wishes to trap, you need written permission. That's it. 22 states have this requirement now, and we urge Minnesota to become the 23rd state. I have one testifier, Bill Palmquist, who is a council member from Afton. He'll give a brief background as to his support for it. And I'll note for the record, I've had this introduced for 1 month. I have not heard any opposition.
All right. Well, thank you, if you don't mind proceeding. And members around the table, there was an amendment that was handed out, but this is for another bill. So we'll just set this aside for now. Sir, if you'd like to state your name for the record and proceed, and I'd just like to, I guess, remind folks that we are going to be running short on time towards the end of committee, so if we're able to keep our remarks brief, okay. But of course still make your points.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Palmquist. I'm a city councilman in Afton. Just wanted to, we dealt with this issue back in 2013, which I think is why I'm here. So the issue was first raised when there were some negative incidents with pets and traps in some of our neighboring communities. And as we looked into it more, we learned that under the current statutes, it's permissible to put traps on private land if it's not properly posted, without the landowner's knowledge. That was very surprising to us. So in the end, we tried to balance what we were going to do. We have a lot of residents who live on large wooded lots. So the idea that they could be on there without their knowledge was the primary reason. However, another strong argument why we did what we did was we didn't want to live in a community dominated with no trespassing posted signs for residents who might have an issue with this, but not with everything else covered under the outdoor recreational activities that does give them access to non-posted lands. So we were trying to strike a balance. In the end, we did ban traps and public rights away our small public parks and then put in a process for permitting, which was just to make sure everybody knew they were there. Landowners still can allow it. And we were really just trying to balance safety concerns with basically property rights, both for and against, for people who wanted to allow this, but also for people who didn't. So thank you.
Thank you. All right. Any additional testimony on this bill? Mr. Lestico, we have you up. Please, you can approach the table two at a time if you'd like. And again, if you don't mind stating your name for the record and proceeding.
My name is Gary Lestico. I'm an attorney. I represent the Minnesota Trappers Association. We have reviewed this bill. We'd be in opposition to it. Trespass law allows for landowners to exclude anyone from their land if they either verbally have them removed or they post the land. It can be extremely burdensome to actually go through the process of getting written permission, which this requires rather than even just verbal permission, which is what most trappers do in most cases. Most trappers will call every year, ask the landowners, get permission. Oftentimes, they don't even have the ability to physically meet with them. They can be vacant landowners, they can live out of state, and they have a process where they do that, but it doesn't allow for written permission. It can also be, in many cases, difficult for landowners that will call up a trapper and have an immediate problem. So they'll have damage from beaver flooding, or they'll have livestock being preyed on, and they'll call up a trapper and they'll say, "We need you to go out right away and take care of the problem." Again, they're vacant landowners, or they do not live near the property, and the trapper doesn't have access to that landowner. This would make that extremely difficult. In fairness, all outdoor activities have this requirement. If any landowner wants to exclude people from the land, they can simply post the land. The statute's relatively straightforward, and they can do that. It's not a big sign. It's a very little sign. The statute sets that out. Typically, if they just post a no trespassing at the entrance points of the property, people stay off it. And so we would oppose this bill for those reasons.
Okay. Thank you, sir. If you don't mind stating your name for the record and proceeding.
My name is Ray Sogard. I'm president of the Minnesota Forest Zone Trappers Association. I live in northern Minnesota, St. Louis County. Our organization was formed for two reasons. One, to protect trapping rights, but the other was to protect public and private lands. This is a map of Minnesota. The red area and the blue area is basically where the forest zone of Minnesota is. As you can see, the land encompassed by the forest zone is 95% of the public land in the state of Minnesota. We protect that land as best we can, and we are by far the most respectful of all private landowner rights, because number one, we are landowners in the state also and in our area. We oppose the bill for same reasons as Gary stated, but also we take opposition to the fact that we are not the ones abusing this, as I'm sure Mr. Wieger is intention to only trappers. You just had people up here who run dogs, and when they have collars on their dogs, they have a range of 9 miles. And in the 9 mile range, does a dog know if he's on private land? No, he doesn't. But you don't ask that this also include hunting for dogs. Why not?
And sir, if you don't mind just addressing your comments to the committee here.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Trapping is an emotional issue, just as hunting is for the people that were just up here. No, I think that this We oppose this because 95% of the landowners will not give written permission due to insurance issues if someone got hurt on their property. And that's a big deal. But they will give you verbal permission on a regular basis, because then they have some form of deniability. So,
okay. Well, thank you for your testimony. We appreciate that. Any questions among the committee right now? Otherwise, I think we have one more testifier that has indicated he'd like to speak. Mr. Sicola? Okay, very good. All right, well, thank you. In the interest of time, we'll open it up. DNR, yes, if you'd like to state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. And I do appreciate Senator Wigger bringing this bill forward, and it was great to hear from Apple Valley. This is a local control issue. It's not a one-size-fits-all situation throughout the state. We've heard testimony from the Northern or the Forest Zone Trappers Association about the amount of public and private land in the forested zone. There's hundreds of thousands of acres of land, and the state has actually paid for $43-44 million worth of access to these private forest lands for purposes of hunting and fishing and public access, and also to prevent the defragmentation with the Outdoor Heritage Fund, that now you would have to contact, if this bill were to go into law, you'd have to try to contact a landowner to be able to pursue your outdoor recreational opportunities that would be trapping. So we do have large concerns. Minnesota is quite different than any other state in the nation with the amount of industrial private forest land that is open to the public right now. So this land is really limiting the needs or the ability of people throughout the state of Minnesota to access these hundreds of thousands of acres of what is essentially public land but is actually private. So if this law were to go in effect, you would be needing to contact Boise, Blandon, Potlatch, Mopus, these large land-holding companies, and asking them for written permission. And I am very hesitant to say that they would actually provide written permission, just as a previous testifier had stated. So with that, Mr. Chairman, we do have some concerns about the way this bill is drafted, and we do believe the best issue is best dealt with at the local level. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Any additional testimony at this stage? Any questions among committee members? Well, Senator Wigger, as we've done with the other bills, we will be laying Senate File 591 over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. So thank you for bringing this to our attention today. Up next, we have, you don't need to move, Senate File 592. And Senator Wigger, if you'd like to speak to this bill.
Yes. Mr. Chair, subcommittee members, recognizing the tight timeline, Senate File 592 basically prohibits trapping and baiting of wolves and prohibits the use of snares to take a wild animal. And we'll pass around a snare. I believe most of you are aware of what they are. But to visualize it again, we'll pass it around. And I'll ask Dr. Maureen Saka to testify on the need.
All right. Thank you, Senator Wigger. And if you don't mind stating your name for the record.
Sure. Good afternoon, Chairman Schmidt. My name is Maureen Hackett, and I'm president and founder of Howling for Wolves. Thank you for taking this testimony today on Senate File 592, which is eliminating the use of snares for trapping as a method, and also to protect gray wolves from recreational trapping and baiting. This has nothing to do with any kind of control of wolves for predation. This is all about recreational trapping and baiting of wolves, and then the elimination of snaring of all wildlife. Snares are simple. You can see this. They're very rudimentary. They have not evolved in the last several thousand years. They're meant to choke an animal to death, but frequently they grab other body parts of an animal and cause disembowelment, amputations, and disabilities. And for many animals are not even targeted, but they're caught in snares because snares are cheap and people saturate snare, meaning they put enough snares out that sort of saturates the area and they'll get something. So the research on non-targeted animals varies from anywhere from 20% to 80%. It's obviously going to be sort of difficult to research this kind of stuff. We oppose the use of snares because it is one of the most non-discriminating, indiscriminate forms of trapping. It causes the most injuries that the animals later die from, and they're not even found, so it's a total waste of if somebody was trying to kill that animal. And for the wolves, they die of what's called frequently jellyhead, where the blood pumping to the brain keeps going because of their strong muscle neck, but then the blood coming out of the head and brain and eyes is slowed down, so they have this swollen head that are referred to as jellyheads, and it's because of this extreme lymph fluid and blood that builds up, and it's horribly painful. So we're asking to eliminate this as a form of trapping. We know a lot of wolves were caught by snares in the trapping season. We feel that even the most experienced trappers, such as Carter Niemeyer, gave us a statement that we could put on this handout where he said, you know, he's never even used snares because they are so very non-selective, and they catch everything, and they're extremely debilitating to the animals, creating disabilities that they later die from. We know for a fact a moose was killed in a snare by getting caught around its noose, just around its snout of the moose. Eagles have been caught, songbirds, domestic dogs, lots of animals. So we do have a statement here, and to stay on the topic of snaring, Peggy Farr, who is a wildlife rehab specialist, wrote a letter so that you can all have it, and I'll just highlight what she says about the animals that they have seen in their rehabilitation center. She has seen snares embedded in various body parts of wild animals, including their neck, their abdomen, around their leg, and basically they suffer slow and terrible deaths unless they're caught and maybe treated and successfully. Basically, the wildlife belongs to all of us. We've just heard about all the public lands that all the taxpayer dollars are paying for, where people are able to take these animals for their own uses with a license fee. But to use a snare, you're killing possibly, is it 3-to-1, 5-to-1, non-target animals to the animal you're targeting? Nobody knows. Nobody can tell. And we're asking for this to not be a use of our a method that Minnesotans are allowed to use because it's unethical, it's disrespectful, and the wildlife does belong to all of us. And like landmines, really, snares are kind of indiscriminate, and they kill and maim anything they can grab. And with regard to trapping wolves, we're asking that the public voice be heard on this. We did a poll, Lake Research Partners did a poll that showed 66% of the public opposed the use of trapping and baiting for killing wolves. 66% opposed the use of traps and snares. They also really, even higher percentage, oppose the use of distress calls to call in the wolves and baiting ahead of time using meat piles. So we think that the public most of the time turns a blind eye, but now that the spotlight's been turned on to wolf baiting, trapping, and snaring, we think we can at least eliminate this as a recreational activity and snaring of all wildlife so that that wildlife can be enjoyed by the vast majority of the public to be alive and viewed and photographed.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Hackett. Any questions or discussion among the committee members? All right. At this stage, we'll open it up for additional testimony. We have Mr. Lestico, Mr. Sogard, if you'd like to turn to the testifiers' table. And again, if you don't mind stating your name for the record and proceeding.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Gary Lestico. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Trappers Association. We do oppose this bill. Our members lawfully and ethically snare and trap all over the state, and they have for since the establishment of the state. Wolf trapping is no different than any other trapping. Foot traps, modern foot traps today that trappers use are essentially just a tool that holds the animal until the trapper checks the set. Snares are used the same way. They are not a barbaric device, as testified to. They are not what they have always been. They are modern snares. This is a very modern snare using aircraft cable is what most trappers use. Snaring is indispensable for removing certain types of predators, coyotes, fox. In the climate that Minnesota has in the snow, regular foot traps just cannot operate all the time. Many trappers take large number of coyote and fox predators of small game and game birds, and they do so ethically within the laws that are established in the state. I don't know where the statistics come from as to the number of non-target. Our members are use snares very selectively. They're at least as selective, if not more selective, than foot traps based on how the snare is set, where the snare is set, the size of the snare, what type of set. They can be very selective for any particular type of species that the trapper has. I've set thousands of snares. I've caught thousands of animals. They are very selective. There's almost no incidental catch using those snares, regardless if it's for wolf or for other type of animals trap. The testimony of the jellyhead issue with, I'm not sure exactly what they're referring to of that. I have caught and been present when wolves have been snared. I've never seen anything having to do with the jellyhead. I've read of it. I'm not aware of any evidence indicating that that has occurred in Minnesota. I cannot speak to what happens in other areas other than Minnesota. And in the DNR results, the DNR has been keeping track of dogs that have incidentally been trapped. I cannot find a single incident where a dog has been killed in a snare. So on behalf of our members, we do oppose this bill.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Lestico. We appreciate that.
Ray Sogard,
if you don't mind restating your name for the tape and proceeding.
Ray Sogard, Minnesota Forest Zone Trappers Association. Just a couple of points. By controlling predators, the trapper is also controlling the spread of disease such as mange. Although mange is a disease caused by a parasite that in effect destroys the predator's coat and the animal then dies of exposure, many are unaware that humans can also suffer from this disease. Keeping this disease in check is additional service provided by the trapper. Snares can be set and used in such a manner that they exclude incidental takes of non-target animals such as deer and coyotes, or in case of moose, we are required to put, when doing wolves, we are required to use a moose avoidance technique so they do not get caught in there. Snares must be set and manufactured to either lethal or non-lethal use. And this can be found in the best management practices or the Chicago Coyote studies. Snares are nearly impervious to the weather and dramatic conditions under which we trap in Minnesota. Low-cost user is simply setting with a minor construction needed in the location. Snares built for use around domestic animals have been proven to cause little or no damage or both, and wild animals captured for research. This is also best management practices. Snare studies from Wisconsin, Missouri, Pennsylvania, South Dakota, and Tennessee. Snares also allow young trappers to become snaremen relatively quickly and at a very low cost. And providing an opportunity for young trappers to become proficient at that, our tradition, which is now 400 years old. We try to do that as best as we can and as often as we can.
All right. Well, thank you for that testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to speak to the issue?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Eaton, please.
Thank you. I don't remember the previous testifier's name, but I'd like to see some of those studies that show the snaring is safe. I've not seen them before, and saying that they exist is a little different than actually reading them.
All right. Well, if folks do have studies, if you'd like to pass it on to the subcommittee, we'll definitely distribute it to our members or deal with the members individually. Sir, if you'd like to state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. Be very brief. Minnesota Farmers Union, our policy does feel that there is a healthy wolf population in Minnesota that does support a hunting and trapping season. And we do feel that trapping has been effective in managing our wolf population in Minnesota, and we would urge you not to include this in your division report. We're very concerned about the current situation. If we are going to go back to a situation like we had before, we felt that the trapping and hunting season also provided funds to the department for the work they were doing on wolf management. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. All right, any additional? Yes, if you'd like to state your name for the record.
Once again, Mr. Chairman, Corey Bennett, representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. Very quickly, Mr. Chairman, I don't have anything more to add of significance other than to say that this is something that, again, our corporate board took a position on opposing unanimously at our last meeting, and we support the current Minnesota Wolf Management Plan that has the trapping as part of that overall plan. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, we oppose this.
Thank you. All right, Dr. Hackett, if you'd like to briefly add to your previous testimony.
I did not bring up the graphic. A couple of things. 20 states have eliminated snaring effectively. Snaring. 20 states have eliminated it. Second, we did not offer the graphic images. We have some of the forms of trapping. The snaring, you'll see as it disemboweled this one animal here, it's a wolf. But we have photos of dogs that have had their nooses and snouts snared. I've seen a video of a moose dead just with a little snare around its noose, snout. It was very bizarre, even to the trapper. He didn't understand how it happened. So we know that things are happening out there that are not recorded. Animals die unrecorded. And finally, we know that the wolf quota was met with the firearm seasons. Whatever was set was always overreached, and they met their limits, and they reserved a portion of the take for trapping. They didn't need to. They killed as many wolves as they needed to with the firearms. So trapping and baiting and snaring wolves is not only not necessarily necessary, but it's indiscriminate and kills a lot of other animals. We just heard it. It's cheaper. It's easier. You don't need a professional. The young guys can do it. Anybody can snare, put thousands out there, kill thousands of animals, and many thousands go unknown. And these are the public's animals. I think we need to look at, you know, the public and not just the individual that wants that one animal, and how many animals does it take to get it.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Hackett. Any additional testimony? We have DNR, if you don't mind restating your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, yes, members, Bob Myers, Department of Natural Resources. I do have two professional biologists I would like to have testify on this. The first is John Erb, who's our research biologist dealing with the snaring issue, and then our large carnivore specialist, Dan Stark, to talk about the wolf issue. I'll bring them both up at the same time.
Thank you. And gentlemen, if you don't mind, just whoever would like to proceed first, state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Stark. I'm the large carnivore specialist for the DNR. Just briefly, the wolf season is the most highly regulated and monitored season we have in the state for any species that's hunted or trapped. It's restricted based on the number of licenses, the number of hunters, the time frame of the season that the season occurs, and then we have a harvest target where when we're at or approaching that number, we close the season. Trapping has been one of the most common methods for capturing wolves humanely and effectively, not only for depredation control, but also for research purposes. We live capture wolves, put radio collars on them, track their movements. It's a very effective tool and a safe tool for handling wildlife. We've also started using snares to capture wolves in the winter months, which has also been effective at capturing safely and humanely to radio collar wolves and track their movements. In regards to baiting and use of calls, the wolf season success rates are extremely low compared to other seasons that we have for hunting of wildlife. The average hunting success is about 5%, comparing that to bear hunting or even deer hunting, which is much higher, 25% or higher for bear hunting in recent years. So even with the use of bait or using a call, there's it's still considered, as we'd recognize it, as a fair chase for those species. Okay. And with that, I'll turn it over to John Erb.
Thank you. If you'd like to state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Erb. I'm a fur bear and wolf research biologist with the DNR up in Grand Rapids. Just real briefly, regarding snares, it is correct that they are fairly simple devices, but there are a lot of components to them that allow diverse uses, both for live restraining animals and as killing traps if used in the right locations. We and biologists around the country have used snares or forms of snares very successfully to live capture and radio collar and study foxes, coyotes, raccoons, beavers, wolves. Currently here in Minnesota, we're doing that. So there is a tremendous amount of diversity. There is also published data and soon-to-be-published data from National Trap Research Program, where we have formally tested many forms of snares for live restraining animals. And many of the ones we've tested, most of the ones we've tested, meet the standards that are laid out in best management practices for trapping animals, fully necropsied by veterinarians after they were collected in the research. So there is a significant amount of data regarding live restraining these species to show that it can be done very humanely. With killing snares, there is less information on the effectiveness or the percent of the time that's successful, but there is a lot of diversity in the devices, and that needs to be understood, that a snare is not a snare. There's many different versions and components that you can use to release certain animals that are able to apply a lot of pressure to increase selectivity. You can add components to decrease the likelihood it will kill something or increase the likelihood. But again, main point is there is a lot of research showing that they can be used to humanely live restrain animals.
Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen. If you could just answer one question or clarify for the record, how often do trappers have to check their traps or snares if they're set in the season?
For traps for non-killing traps, it's daily checks. For traps that are known to be killing, like the body gripping traps or traps set for submersion sets for aquatic animals, it's every 3 days. For live restraining, daily checks.
Great. Well, thank you, gentlemen. There's no further. Oh, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment that I don't disagree that it's legal and that it's effective to snare and trap animals, but that doesn't mean that it's right or ethical. It's not something that a treatment that we would allow for our domestic pets that we would think was okay. And I don't know why it's okay, because they're not domesticated.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Wieger.
I understand it's your intent just to get testimony, not to have debate, and to more lay it over for subsequent potential inclusion and then further debate at another time. But I'd just like to note one item for DNR on trapping. We have, except as authorized by the commissioner, the Predator Control Program, that would not affect that. The commissioner would still be able to weigh in. That's a Section 10, Subdivision 8 at page 3. So, yeah, we are sensitive to some use, and obviously for predator control. But I just wanted to note that for the record. There can be possible clarification if needed, but we are sensitive to that.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. We appreciate that. Any additional comments?
Mr. Chair, I just note that it will still prevent the use of snares for private people as well, and given that the data shows that it can be done effectively and humanely, again, just reiterating that.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate that. All right. If there's any additional testimony in the audience, you can please approach the witness table, or the testifiers table, I should say. And folks, we are running short on time, so we're going to have to keep our remarks very brief here moving forward. If you don't mind stating your name for the record and proceeding.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jeffrey Wiles, a citizen of Coon Rapids, Minnesota. And my comment is pertaining just only to, quote-unquote, the practice of recreational snaring. I just want to emphasize, which to me is the importance and sensibility of that statement in the Howling for Wolves sheet from Carter Niemeyer. I've never used snares at all. because they are very non-selective. They catch everything that will go through them. Snares are very dangerous. And I would add one thing both to pets and wildlife and to pets, period. That's all I have to say, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, sir. We appreciate that. Well, seeing no additional testimony or discussion at this point, we will lay Senate File 592 over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you, Senator Wieger.
Thank you.
All right, we are now moving on to Senate File 1070, and I do recall that we had an amendment passed out to the table. Senator Wieger, would you like this amendment moved?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you.
All right, we'd like to give Senator Wieger an opportunity to get this bill in the shape he'd like it. So I'd like to, or Senator Hoffman moves that the A1 amendment to Senate File 1070 be moved. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Wieger, if you'd like to proceed.
Yes, and thank you. And this completes all of my bills relating to the subjects this year, and thank you for the hearing. Senate File 1070, as amended, addresses body-gripping traps. And actually, I received the bill from Representative McNamara. We've addressed body-grip traps in the past. And as we have here, it would state you could not set, place, or operate a body-gripping trap except as a water set within 150 feet of the center line of a public road or public trail. And the amendment adds clarification on public road and public trail. I have with me, for my only witness, Scott Slocum, and he'll state the reason why he's supporting.
All right, sir, welcome back to the committee. If you don't mind stating your name for the record and proceeding.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Scott Slocum, resident of White Bear Lake. A lot of dogs are killed while they're walking with their owners along roads and trails. And I think this is an excellent idea added to the other protections that are in SF 1325. Because it does protect people who are walking along roads and trails with their dogs. And that is one of the places where the most dogs are killed by body gripping traps. They're set along the right of way on the road, for example, because they're easy to check from there. It's a very successful trapping method, but it's very dangerous for dogs. The amendments that were made today defining public road and public trail are very important to this bill. And the amendment that defines public road looks good, looks like a general definition of public road. The definition of public trail needs to be made more broad, I believe. I looked in state statute for a definition of public trail, and I didn't find one. I saw a definition of state trails, but I did not see a definition of county trails. County trails are very important, too. There was a dog killed along Blueberry Bog Trail just west of Brainerd a couple of years ago. That was Tim Manning. Tim Manning's dog, Bella, if I remember right. They were walking along a county trail grouse hunting with their hunting dog. And this is another place where dogs are commonly killed. And this bill would help protect them. And I hope we have your support for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Slocum. We appreciate your testimony.
And that completes the presentation. We could further work on that definition of trail, but the intent is there.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Wieger, is there something magical about 150 feet? Is there some way you came about 150 feet? I'm just sort of curious where you came up with the number.
Senator Wieger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Osment, Representative McNamara sent me the bill.
Oh, okay.
That's magic.
All right, thank you. Any additional discussion at this stage? If folks would like to testify, please approach the testifiers table. Welcome, ma'am, if you don't mind stating your name for the record and proceeding.
Yes, I'm Nancy Christopher from Cologne, Minnesota. I was very excited when I first saw this, until I kind of started looking at the specifics, and clearly public trails needs a much broader definition. With without that, it's just significantly limits, you know, the effectiveness. So when you're looking at that definition, look at logging trails, tote roads, field access roads, any place where people are walking down a trail, grouse hunting, things like that through the woods, that's where they would be in particular danger of coming across these traps without this setback. Another concern is not redefining water set to be fully submerged. Within that 150 feet, you've got many culverts with 4 inches of water in them, and that's all you really need to have a half-submerged body-gripping trap. These culverts with the 4 inches of water are absolute magnets to dogs and animals, and they're also magnets to slob trappers. So once you close down that 150 feet up along the road, what you leave for these trappers is this culvert. So all of a sudden, you've got an increase in the number of dog deaths because all those traps are now focused in those very narrow culvert areas. So those were my two points where I thought we really needed to fix this in order to get the effectiveness up. That said, after this is done, we would, at best, we're still only going to address about 40% of the body-gripping trap dog deaths. So it's a great start. And in conjunction with 1325, we will maybe have a good package.
Okay. Thank you, ma'am. We appreciate your testimony. Gentlemen, if you'd like to restate your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman. Gary Lustico again on behalf of the Minnesota Trappers Association. The Trappers Association opposes this bill as written. I think the intent is to put additional restrictions on public land, the ditch banks, the road right-of-ways. There are already restrictions on public land trapping with conibears. Any trap that is set of a certain size, which is commonly referred to as the 220, which is what most people have concern about, is that trap has to be set either in a 7-inch recess cubby set, in a 3-foot elevated set, or at least 20 feet from any bait, so it's not associated with bait. That's already in place for all public land. I don't know what the magic is, and I'm quite confident there is no magic to 150 feet. It was just an arbitrary number that came up. It would, by default, push that into private land so that current law allows private landowners to have the right to dictate what is not permitted on their land as far as dogs being present or that certain types of traps or trapping at all is not present. And our position is that landowners should have that position as to their own land, and this would change that mix and balance. I have not been privy to see the amendment to the public roads and trails. I looked. There is not a very well-defined body of law in Minnesota on public roads. In fact, under Minnesota statute, chapter 160, a road can become public just by use and maintenance of a public authority that no one would know that necessarily from any obvious sign or able to observe that. So we'd have trappers innocently getting in trouble without knowing that. To include something like forest roads would greatly compound the inability of trappers to understand where they could legally be or where they couldn't legally be, notwithstanding we oppose this, because these public areas are already protected under current law restrictions to public land. As far as the concern with culverts, that this should be further amended to amend what is now a water set, which is that a body gripping trap has to be set so at least half of the trap is underwater. The concern that was testified to on culverts, it is already in current state law that a trap set around or near a culvert or in a culvert has to be in a completely submerged set. So there would need to be no change. Current law allows that. The purpose of the water set being for the trap half out of the water is that for certain kind of trapping, it is much more efficient to have it half out of the water, and it is much more efficient not to catch incidental catches such as an otter. So a trap being half set out of the water is less likely to catch an otter than a trap fully set under the otter. So by limiting what a trapper needs to do with a water set from where it is now would greatly hamper the ability to trappers to focus on a particular species and to keep from catching a non-target species like an otter. Additionally, with the water set, I believe there's been in the history of the state that I'm aware of, according to anything that the DNR has published or anything that is in the public record, there's only been one dog that has ever been caught in a water set as currently defined, which is where the trap is at least halfway out of the water. Very unfortunate situation, but it just never happens. There was this one situation apparently this fall. That's the only one that we're aware of or the DNR records show has ever occurred. The water set is an extremely important set, and to further restrict it would be very harmful to general wildlife management. This statute or this bill would also require that traps, body gripping traps, they come in many different sizes. It would restrict traps that are not even physically capable of catching a dog. So a 110, a 120, a 150, which are much smaller traps, are limited by this within road right-of-ways or 150 feet regardless of the right-of-way, notwithstanding that they're incapable of catching a dog. So the bill makes it much more complicated to trap with no additional safeguards to pets based on the way it's written. So we would oppose the bill as it now stands.
Okay, thank you for your testimony, sir. If you don't mind restating your name for the record.
Ray Sogard, Minnesota Forest Zone Trappers Association. We have affectionately dubbed this bill the bill of unintended consequences. As it currently stands, from the center line of the road, the right-of-way is 33 feet. If you extend that now to 150 feet, now you're going on 117 feet of private property. Was it the intention of you to regulate an owner's this legislation, in our opinion, would restrict the landowner's use of his own land by the first 117 feet. We think there needs to be some work on this issue. I have not seen the amendment, but if you're working on a definition of roads and trails, I commend you, because what you have here was unacceptable. If you compare the number of dogs in the state to the number actually terminated by traps in a season, you would see that this number is 1/10,000th of 1%. We believe that it is unrealistic to think that you can make legislations to stop an event 100% of the time. Now, in predator trapping, just because I know it's hard to fathom how many predators we actually caught. Last year, we caught 282,122. And just because you don't see them does not mean that they aren't there. And we for one think that there are consequences to this. You would have an increase of predator population. And not only that, in the case of beaver, for example, In our county alone, St. Louis County, our county spent in excess of $300,000 just for removal of beaver in the off season. You better be prepared to come up with a lot of money for the DNR or counties to subsidize them for problems that may occur.
And Mr. Sogard, we are running out of time here, so if you have a couple of final points to make, we're going to have to move on.
Okay, the final point that I have is that this is a public safety issue. If you allow hunting in those ditches, what's going to happen, say, if you're going for a pheasant stands a 50% chance of flying across that road or trail, in which case someone's going to shoot, thus creating a public safety issue, because there could be someone else on that trail and an unintended issue could be a harmed or injured individual or a loss to property damage. If shotgun shell hits pellets hit a vehicle, for example, take out windshield or whatever.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sogard. We appreciate your testimony today. If you'd like to make your comments briefer, and then we will be moving on.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And restate your name for the
very
record.
Very quickly, Scott Slocum, White Bear Lake. Two quick points. This bill does not require water sets to be fully submerged. A lot of the comments were about water sets being fully submerged. That is not a requirement of this bill. The 150 feet is maybe an option. I think the critical thing is the right-of-way, the road right-of-way. Is the critical thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Slocum. We appreciate that. Any additional testimony in the room today? Otherwise, we would like to, very briefly, if you don't mind.
Very briefly, Nancy Christopher Cologne. I just want to say, if it's a tremendous hardship not to put traps in culverts along the road right away, I have a hard time believing that. I'm sorry. Water sets, you know, not in the culverts along the road right away. Come on. This is really a major hardship that's going to cause all these problems.
All right, thank you. All right, at this stage, any additional testimony on this bill? All right, otherwise, as we have with the others, we will be laying Senate File 1070 over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you, Senator Wieger.
Thank you very much for your attention.
I appreciate that. All right, up next, we have Senate File 1325. Senator Hoffman, thank you for waiting patiently. And, folks, we are, of course, beyond our time limit today. We'll try to get through this bill and in a timely fashion. Obviously, we know there's a lot of discussion here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Sir, you have an amendment you'd like to
I do, Mr. Chair. Offer. I'd like to offer my A2 amendment, please.
All right. Sir Hoffman offers the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It is indeed an honor to be here as the commissioner of the DNR is here as well today. And I believe testifying on the bill, but with me today giving testimony are going to be Denise Schultz, Scott Slocum, Kurt Banner, and Sherry Adland. And Sherry has her granddaughter here today testifying as well. But I just want to be real quick, Mr. Chair and members. Bronco, Lily, Daisy are a few names of dogs that have been killed in Minnesota body grip traps during the 2014-2015 trapping season. And there's a dog named Kobe that is so maimed by a body grip trap that he lost both eyes and a hearing in one ear. These are just but a few examples of the unintended consequences of trapping methodologies in Minnesota. What Senate File 1325 does not inhibit fur trapping, which is a Minnesota industry, a great Minnesota industry to note. It will just make it safer for dogs and other family pets. This is about safety of dogs. Mr. Chair and members, you're going to hear from search and rescue. Search and rescue dogs, SAR, are a huge risk since they cannot be selective on when they are deployed. You know, they work off-leash on private and public land. Body grips, traps are a significant risk to these highly trained, very expensive, and critical resources that support law enforcement in life and death situations. There are very few of these special dogs in the state of Minnesota. Just let me briefly go on some rare statistics for the next 35 minutes, if you don't care, Mr. Chair.
You're on the clock, Sir Hoffman, and we're hoping you're a little bit shorter than that.
I'll just do a 10,000 feet above. Since 2012, more than 25 dogs have been killed in body grip conibear-type traps. During the current trapping season, the Minnesota DNR has reported the death of 7 dogs in 90 days. One of the dogs was a mother of 2-week-old puppies. Many dogs have been killed while merely walking with their owners. Some have been killed while exercising and hunting in public wildlife management areas, and some have been killed on private land in pursuit of bait body grip traps on the ground. Number two, I just say Minnesota trapping laws that aren't protecting dogs. Minnesota laws allow for the placement of body grip traps on the ground where dogs can access them. The Minnesota law also allows baited traps to be set on the ground in enclosures that do not keep dogs out. Minnesota trapping laws are for approximately 10,000 trappers in 2014 versus approximately 150,000 upland game and waterfowl hunters, most of which have dogs in their hunting party. And the approximately 53% of Minnesota households that have dogs are at risk with other traps. And I just want to talk about some other states that have successfully managed trapping and dog owners. Many states restrict the use of body grip traps more aggressively than Minnesota. 13 restrict them on the ground, and 8 require them to be elevated. More than 50% of the states require traps to be checked every day or every 24 hours. and states where body grip traps have been restricted. The trappers continue to trap, and the predators are still controlled. Trapping continues to flourish in these states. One example of that, the data shows Missouri trapped approximately 60,000 more raccoons than Minnesota. That's 138,000 versus 79,000, and approximately 3,000 more bobcats, and no dogs were killed. So trapping, harvest, and predator control is not determined by the use of body grip traps. The number of trappers is not determined by the use of body grip traps. The control of predators is not determined by body grip traps. They are determined, Mr. Chair, by fur prices. Per the fur-bearing expert in the Wisconsin DNR, restrictions to body grips had no impact on the harvest. That's what he said. So there are alternatives, Mr. Chair, and at this point I'd like to turn the discussion over to the testifiers. And with me is our current DNR commissioner.
Well, thank you, Senator Hoffman, and welcome, Commissioner. Thank you for waiting patiently today.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. For the record, my name is Tom Landwehr. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. And, Mr. Chairman, members, I'm here today to speak in favor of this legislation. The administration believes that it is important to reduce accidental dog deaths, and we believe this will do it. I recognize that this will require trappers to retool their efforts as they go afield, but given the intense use that our lands and waters receive from multiple users, we believe that the change is warranted, Mr. Speaker, and that's my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, thank you, sir. Seeing no questions or discussion at this point, we would call the next testifier up to the table. And thanks again, Mr. Commissioner. We appreciate your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, let's bring Denise Schultz up and Scott Slocum at the same time, and then we can start to move through that.
Welcome, ma'am, if you don't mind stating your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm hoping to get through this without having to take a coughing break, so I'll apologize in advance if I do. My name is Denise Schultz. I live in Victoria, Minnesota. I'm a volunteer search and rescue canine handler for an all-volunteer group here in Minnesota. I grew up in northern Minnesota. I've been around trapping and hunting my whole life. My reason for being here today is that the body grip traps pose a real and urgent danger to our search and rescue dogs. We're required to work on private land, public land, wherever there's somebody missing. Much of it's in the areas we're trapping is ideal. We can't choose where we search, and each specific situation presents risks to the handlers and the dogs. One of the biggest risks are these traps. I've searched with my canine partner for an armed and paranoid subject, sent her into rodent-infested buildings with holes in the floors, fallen down riverbanks, searched in the dark in bad terrain, and generally put her at risk in many ways. These were real risks, and there were times when I was scared, but nothing scares me like these traps. I'm not here to try to eliminate their use. I just want to find a way to keep them off the ground. Traps on the ground, even in their current legal cubbies, will not keep search dogs from accessing the bait and killing the dog. I have two dogs. Ava's 8 years old and certified by the North American Police Work Dog Association in area scent, also called air scent. We're tested as a team every 12 months to maintain our mission-ready status. My other dog, Churchill, is 8 months old, driving me crazy, and also in training for the area search. I've heard it said that there are a lot of dogs in Minnesota. It was talked about just now. So what if you get killed in the traps? A dog should be on a leash anyway, right? Area search dogs work off-leash and are trained to work either scent-specific, where we have an article from the person who's missing, or general, where they'll go out and find anybody human in the area. And that's helpful when you have, say, two or three people missing at the same time. There are a number of reasons why the dogs have to work without a leash. They can work many times faster when they're not tied to a pathetic human that slows them down. Leashes, even long lines, get tangled in brush and can pose a hazard to the dog and the handler in harsh terrain. Off-leash search dog can access areas that many humans can't reach, brushy riverbanks, small caves, collapsed buildings, and so on. If they're off-leash, they can determine the direction of travel we need to go by using the wind and so on. While we do work the dogs on a long line from time to time, it's mostly in urban settings, and it slows down the process in situations where time is of the essence. Air scent dogs range quite a distance from the handler, often out of sight, and can sometimes catch the scent cone from a subject from a half mile away. These traps are set and placed by humans. My dog is trained to find humans. Even if gloves or other scent blocking measures are taken, there is a a human trail up to the trap that a search dog will follow. And if they're not working scent specific, it's a particular danger. They're baited with meat. These are dogs. They're going to go for it. Some people have stated that training your dog to eat things, not to eat things that don't come from your hand, is the answer. Dogs trained this way are in big trouble if something happens to their handler, and it's not recommended for well-socialized search dogs. Some people say that these traps can be removed in time to save the dog's life, and I really don't believe it. At a multi-unit training session in Duluth a while back, we practiced trying to open the traps with zip ties and some of these other methods that people have come up with. None of them worked. I couldn't get the trap open. And keep in mind, you're not working with a thrashing 80-pound dog in the trap. We were just practicing. We finally came up with kind of a homemade tool. I still don't think it'll work. I keep it in my pack just in case. But I think I'd be bringing home a dead dog at the end of the day no matter what. I want to tell you what is lost if one of these dogs is killed by a trap. For one thing, there just aren't that many certified dogs available at any given time. I don't have specific statistics for the state of Minnesota, but I think there are less than 10 fully certified air scent dogs in Minnesota at this time. I'm talking about dogs that are trained to find live humans, not dead ones. But there are a number of cadaver dogs, trailing dogs, and some cross-trained dogs, all of whom also would be at risk from these traps. If there's a lost or missing person, the chances of a number of air scent dogs being available for any given search are pretty low, so they are valued. And also, because there are so few live find air scent dogs, our call-out area is regional rather than just our own backyard. I've been on searches on the Gunflint Trail in Roseau, Chisholm, Crosby, Brainerd, Garrison, and Thief River Falls, along with other Minnesota locations and Wisconsin. It takes at least 2 years to get a dog to be mission ready, and the human has to be trained as well, which is sometimes harder than training the dog. As I stated, I have to recertify annually. Our unit trains every weekend, and we have to be ready to go at all times. We fund all our own equipment, vet bills, supplies, food, transportation, and lodging. Our unit does not engage in fundraising. So in addition to the investment of time spent training ourselves and our dogs, there's a huge monetary commitment on our part. My final point is this. If a search dog is needlessly killed by a trap, there could be a cost in human terms as well. A dead dog is not going to find the missing hunter with a broken leg, the Alzheimer's walk away, or the lost two-year-old. Thank you for your time.
I appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Sir, if you'd like to restate your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Mr. Chair, yes, sir, Kurt Boehner, is after Scott. So
if you'd like to approach the witness stand, please. Yes, proceed.
I'm Scott Slocum from White Bear Lake, Minnesota. 3 years ago, my little companion dog was killed. He was off leash with me. He was not a danger to anyone. In our suburban neighborhood, residential neighborhood. When I read the sheriff's report later on, I learned that the trapper and his son had recently completed Minnesota Trapper's Education. I took that course too, and it's a good course. It does good work. It teaches trapper ethics, trapping ethics. Thing is that they had just finished that course, and they didn't follow the trapping ethics. They are optional. One of the trapping ethics is that if there's a likelihood that you're going to kill someone's dog by setting a trap, that you probably should not set that trap. That's very simple. That's a rule that's broken, an ethical rule that's broken regularly. And as good as Minnesota Trapper Education is, it hasn't solved this problem. So how do we solve the problem? We make it required. We put it into law. We put the ethic into law. We require trappers to take precautions to avoid killing people's dogs. There is a lot of justification for anything that is legal. Every time there is a dog that is killed or harmed by a trap, and there's a newspaper article about that, there will be comments from citizens underneath that article just rationalizing that action because it was legal.
That's the sole justification, oftentimes, is that it is legal. We need to make it illegal. We need to require trappers to take precautions to avoid killing people's dogs. Otherwise, the dogs will continue to be killed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Slocum. We appreciate your testimony. If you'd like to state your name for the record, sir.
Sure. Thank you. My name is Kurt Berner. Thank you, Senators, for hearing my testimony. I'm here as an upland bird hunter and a person who has two bird dogs. In the fall of 2011, I went out for a day's grouse hunt and nearly missed having my young pointer trapped in a body grip trap. I saw the trap. My dog was off doing what she's supposed to do at about 120, 150 yards from me. I panicked. I called her back. She came in, and I grabbed her collar, and we went back to the car, and it was a near miss that ended well. Shortly thereafter, I wrote a letter to Commissioner Landwehr and said, I support trappers. They do an important management role in curbing predators relative to upland birds and waterfowl, but there's got to be a way to solve this problem. I had a quick response back from Mr. Bogus, and he writes, like you, we are concerned with limiting the risk for hunting dogs while preserving opportunities for trappers. In recent weeks, we've been working closely with dog owners, trapping organizations, and legislators on a number of changes aimed at protecting dogs from accidental catches and body gripping traps. I'd like to just point out this is in 2011. How many dogs have been killed since then or maimed? As a result of my involvement with this, my six upland bird hunting friends, also who have dogs, hunt in Minnesota only before mid-October when the trapping season begins, myself included. We go elsewhere. I used to bring people in from out of state, hire non-resident license fee. They don't come here. I wouldn't invite them to Minnesota to hunt rough grouse or pheasants after the trapping season is open. You know, in a loose analysis, this results in thousands of dollars of lost income for hotels, for restaurants, for bars in northern Minnesota. I think that's a study that should be undertaken. I think the Tourism Bureau should be involved with this discussion. It was pointed out earlier, I'd like to restate, there are approximately 150,000 upland bird hunter, or waterfowl hunters and upland bird hunters combined. They don't all have bird dogs. Many of them do. I would say most hunting parties have a dog with them. 53% of Minnesota households have dogs. There's approximately 10,000 trappers in this state. This situation is really out of balance. It's really out of balance. I've been astonished by what I've seen and heard since becoming involved in this effort 3 years ago. Is a $10 coon pelt worth the dog's life? Especially when there are other safe methods that can be used to manage predators and not kill and maim our dogs, whether they be working dogs, whether they be hunting dogs, or somebody's pet. The other thing that I really find astounding is, from a public relations standpoint, the thing that brings trapping into the focal point, into the searchlight, is when WCCO television does a special like they did on Bronco, interviewing the owner of that dead dog and asking him how he felt. I just don't understand how the Minnesota Trappers Association allows that kind of negative public relations when this situation could be resolved in a way that I think is suitable for all parties concerned and the resources shared equitably. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berner. We appreciate your testimony. All right, we have a couple of additions to our testifiers table. Welcome to the subcommittee. Thank you for waiting patiently. If you'd like to state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and chair members, committee members. My name is Sherry Adland, and I'm from Coon Rapids, Minnesota. I have hunting dogs, highly trained hunting dogs, but more importantly, they are beloved family pets. They are members of our family. I'd like to state that neither myself nor Dog Lovers for Safe Trapping is anti-trapping. I think we all believe that there is room for trapping and hunting and fishing and hiking and bird watching and any other form of involvement in nature, but it needs to be done responsibly. The current laws, as they're written, do not protect the majority of hunting dogs and pets, which far outnumber trappers, and I'd really like to see that changed. So because of the fear that I have about our dogs dying in a body grip trap, we don't hunt here either during trapping season. We've gone as far as Saskatchewan to do our hunting. I brought my seventh grade granddaughter here with me today. She has a hunting dog as well. She wants to hunt. I can't imagine taking her during trapping season and having her watch her dog succumb to this. I've been asked to read a letter written by a woman whose family lost a dog this fall to a Conibear 220. And she and her family were devastated by this experience, and I can honestly say I would not be able to read the letter if it was about my dog. So with your indulgence, I'm going to proceed with that letter.
Sure.
On Saturday, November 29th, our lives changed forever when it comes to playing outside and being safe in our own neighborhood. It was a beautiful day. The sun was out, and we intended to take full advantage of it. My children, myself, nieces and nephews, and our dogs, Isabella and Lily, who had her first litter of puppies 2 weeks ago, and Chops, a mini schnauzer. We all played outside all day. It was a great day. At 3 p.m., we decided to go in and have hot cocoa and take a break, and the dogs came in. Lily went and laid with her puppies. This lasted for a few minutes, and then the dogs were back outside. I could see them through the kitchen window running and playing in the snow. At approximately 3:10, my son left to go ice fishing, and our girls were outside, the girls being the dogs. I went back into the house. My husband texted and stated he was coming home and a friend was coming, so I went outside to get the dogs. 3:16, that's when I knew something was wrong. As Isabella and Chops were sitting there looking at me and my husband pulled in, we started searching, calling her name, checking the neighbors, the garages, the sheds. There was no sign of her. It was like she just disappeared. That's when I called 911. Lily was a very expensive hunting dog, and I was thinking she was just gone, just like that. No sound, no nothing. And we had 8 puppies to feed. I filed reports with Cass County and Crow Wing County Sheriff's Departments, and they were a great help in getting the word out. One dispatcher stated it's possible that someone could have stolen her. My next turn was social media. I turned to Facebook to get the word out. I posted on my personal page, every garage sale site, every pet page, Lost Dogs from Minnesota. Lily was viral. We needed to take a break and assess what to do now, as it's 5 o'clock and these puppies are going to be starving. My husband went to Brainerd to get formula and bottles. The kids and I stayed back to keep searching for her and waiting for her to come back. It was now a waiting game. We called our friends who have had puppies, and they told us how to heat the formula and hold the puppies so the liquid doesn't go in their lungs. It's a very precise process. It's not easy. It takes a long time. The kids are trying. They're crying. Everyone is frustrated and sad. But we get it done and cleaned up and turn our attention back to finding Lily. The temperatures are dropping. It's 20 below at 6:30, and we all dressed up and started to search again. And the neighbors are over. Everyone is walking the trails, the woods, the fields, checking barns. I told my husband, let's go get the thermal imaging camera from the fire hall. So we headed to town, driving with the windows down 5.5 miles, searching and calling her name. We walked the ditches, drove the roads, scanned everything. There was no sign of her. It was now 40 below. It was time to take a break and feed the babies. Every 2 or 3 hours, they need to be fed. More crying, tears, frustration. We head back outside to continue with everyone searching. At midnight, I made my last drive thinking she's gone, and I just broke down. So there I am thinking we have 8 baby puppies. We have work. How selfish of someone to take her not only from her family, but from her babies as well. That night, I didn't sleep much, feeding the puppies. Next morning, bright and early, 6:30, minus extreme cold temperatures. The support we had was amazing. People were out driving, walking, helping to find her, feeding the puppies, and via social media there was incredible support, but no luck. 11 a.m., we called it quits. The neighbors had spent long hours helping. We thanked everyone and took a break. At noon, my husband came home, and we went to check the creek again, thinking maybe she fell in. So my husband and I got dressed. We went to the bottom of the hill where the creek was. He went left. I was going right. I decided to take Isabella with me, the other dog. My husband advised me to be careful because the creek is moving and it's deep. Be careful not to fall in, he said. So off we go again. We're walking 35 minutes, and this is where the creek comes to the road. Just then, Isabella came to a point and let out a horrible cry, a howl. I took off running up over the road, and on the other side, wrapped in barbed wire fence, this metal thing around her neck, she was dead, frozen stiff in a patch of tall, dry grass. I was heartbroken, screaming, crying, running, trying to get my husband.
I called him right away. I called 911, told them that I'd found her, and she'd been killed in some sort of trap. So while I waited for my husband and the cops, I started taking photos. I wanted the person who did this to pay. The DNR officer showed up, and he and my husband worked at getting Lily out of the ditch. They picked up the box, but the trap was broken. The safety pin didn't work, and she was frozen, and it was cold, and they couldn't get it off of her. He was so sorry. My husband offered to take her to the shed and warm her up to get the trap off, and we advised the DNR if they needed to take her, they could. Now we needed to tell our children and the world with deepest regrets, Lily has been found and she is no longer with us. My children cried and they became angry. How could someone set a trap so close to our house? Why did this trapper take their pet? Since this trap was close to our house, it very easily could have been one of my kids that could have hit that trap, riding bike, snowmobile, walking the ditch. And this is our neighborhood, where my kids and the neighbor kids play, where they chase each other back and forth and pick agates and build forts and go to the creek. And now our safety has been removed, and being scared is the new norm. So we sat and we cried as a family, and we loved the puppies. My kids wanted to see Lily. We told them they needed to wait as the DNR needed to finish. The next 2 days were very emotional, with lack of sleep, kids having nightmares, puppies needing to be fed, emotional breakdowns, not only from the kids, but Isabella as well. She wouldn't eat. She'd sleep and have nightmares, and she would cry. We got a call from DNR officer that they had everything they needed. They got the trap, and we could bury her. I was thankful, but again, very angry. We lost a family member due to a trapper. If he would have set the trap to laws and regs, which are a joke, we would still have our family member. So my husband heated the ground and dug her grave. The kids built a cross. My husband and I went and wrapped Lily in a sheet and shut her eyes and her jaw the best we could so our kids could have some closure. We carried her to her grave, and each one of my kids said their goodbyes, crying. It's not fair. As my husband is burying her, our Isabella is crying, trying to dig her back out, and then she would run around licking all my children's faces. We all went into the house as we needed to feed the puppies, and then the puppies started to cry and whine and whimper. I wasn't sure what was going on. I crawled into their pool with them, and so did my kids, and we later figured out, once we picked them up, it was the smell of their mama that they recognized. The next 2 weeks were the most exhausting weeks we've ever been through. We had to figure out a way to raise and feed these puppies and get enough sleep and go to work and go to school. We would have neighbors stop by and check on them and feed them if we couldn't. It was amazing how everyone helped us through this. Our Isabella had a form of depression which was also unsettling. She would go outside and lay by Lily's grave and cry. She would try to dig her out. She wouldn't come inside for hours. I was scared she would die of a broken heart. My family and kids could not take much more. All of this was caused by a guy who lived an hour away, didn't know us, decided to set up a trap line from Cushing, Minnesota, all the way to Pequot Lakes, Minnesota. And he would drive his truck to an open waterway, open his door, step down, set up a box with a 220 Conibear trap inside, which the safety pin didn't work on, and the trigger was not set at the right length. So my own family endured all this pain, and the worst part about this, the rules are over 100 years old. They're not safe, and they need to be changed. Respectfully, Rosie and Darren Nordby of Pequot Lakes.
Thank you, Ms. Adlin. We appreciate you sharing that with the committee.
Thank you.
There's some more testifiers, I believe, Mr. Chair, that are on here as well. It looks like Mr. Lestico, Mr. Soygaard, and Mr. Sicola. I don't know if there's anybody else on that. So,
gentlemen, if you'd like to approach the testifiers table. If you don't mind restating your name for the record and proceeding.
Thank you, Chairman. Gary Lestico again on behalf of the Minnesota Trappers Association. I think the Trappers Association is the foremost association trying to remedy what has been testified here today. The association has gone to the legislature, asked for laws which have been passed to require trapper education. We have educated thousands of young trappers. It's been very effective. It's a very good educational model. Many of the dogs that are being complained about, and it is a true tragedy when dogs are caught. I have dogs in my family that are very much part. My kids love them. No one wants a dog to get caught, and trappers least of all want that dog to get caught. There are numbers that are always brought up on these dogs, and if you go and you look at the records, which I have, the vast number of those dogs are caught in illegally set traps. Passing another law won't make those dogs more illegal to catch. They're already illegal to catch. And looking at other states, Minnesota is a very distinctive, unique state. We have prairies in the west, we have true northern forest in the north, and we have everything in between that. which makes it much different. Our weather conditions are much more extreme. For coon trapping, you may have only a few days to a few weeks in any particular season based on the weather. So how trappers are able to set those traps that are productive is very important. It's different in other states. Our fur bears are bigger. So these setbacks and these limitations that are in this bill would exclude coon and bobcat in our state that wouldn't exclude those same animals in southern states. It's a different thing. And we have tried to work with every group that's willing to meet with us on this, and we have done a great deal to remedy the problem. The current law that came in place hasn't been in place for 100 years. It's been in place, I think, 4 years. And the Minnesota Trappers Association brought that statute forward, and it has been successful. Dogs are not getting caught in the recessed cubbies, in the elevated traps, and in the non-bait-associated trap in almost any case. And so we do oppose this bill because the bill goes much beyond what is currently shown as the problem. I hear everybody say that, and there's much testimony today. Everybody testifies, we are not against trapping, but then they say, we just don't want you to use traps. And that is essentially what this bill would limit. There would be no meaningful trapping with body grip traps on dry land in Minnesota for any of the major fur bears that caught. And having dogs caught, you can trap, and you can trap around dogs and not catch dogs. Our members are living proof of that. If they follow the law, they will make it near zero. Nothing is ever zero, but it is near zero. And if you look at the actual catch results, I will go through these with any of the subcommittee members that would ask or anyone else. They are illegally set traps in almost every case. There are some responsibility with dog owners, and some dog owners aren't following the responsibilities of pet ownership, which cause additional problems. But the restrictions that would be placed on current law would make it go to a smaller size trap that these restrictions would go to, the 160, which has been responsible for almost no dog catches, which many trappers have gone to, which because it reduces any potential incidental trap, and it would then make that illegal. As far as the 12-inch recessed for any meaningful size trap, it would not be practical. It just wouldn't work. Just as the 5-foot elevated, it's 3 feet now. That 3-foot elevation came about very calculatedly as protecting non-target animals, and it has worked. There is no record of any dog. It actually came about in the federal lawsuit that Minnesota was part at on restrictions on a climbing animal, the Canada lynx. No lynx have ever been caught in a 3-foot recessed trap in Minnesota. No dog has ever been caught in a 3-foot elevated trap. In fact, in no elevated trap is there any record of any dog being caught. And so this law, you can't set a trap 5 feet in the air. A person, my daughter trapped, she couldn't physically do it. Any young person, any old person, any disabled person could never set that trap. And there's actually no indication that these regulations are needed to protect pets. Pets are being protected. And pets are important. But farmers call us up and ask us to go trap. And they have their crops damaged. Just like the Farm Bureau representative on the additional allowances for deer removal in those areas. It matters to them that their crops are damaged. It matters to them that their livestock is damaged. Might be able to do it different in Missouri, but under what we're living with in this state, we are trapping in the way that needs to be trapped. Trappers are only using what's effective. They're doing what they need not to catch dogs. And if they follow the law, that will be the case. If they break the law, it simply needs to be enforced. And that is why we're in opposition to this law as it's written. One other thing that hasn't been mentioned is, in addition to that, there is the private property written permission. We've testified earlier, and I would just my remarks would be the same on this bill. And then there's a requirement that all pet or companion animals be reported. This would be extremely burdensome both for trappers and for the DNR as far as the bureaucracy. And if you look at the statute that is embedded in this bill as what to define pet or companion animal, 343.20 subdivision 6, it would include any animal owned, possessed, by, cared for, or controlled by a person for the present or future enjoyment of that person. It'd be any animal if you would own it. All different types of animals are owned. Minnesota Rule 9502.0435, subpart 12, defines pets in many different ways to include rats and mice. This law would require a trapper, anyone that caught a mouse or a rat, to report it by the very language of the statute, and it would be imposed with a 90-day jail sentence if that person did do so. So we do oppose these for that reason. Notwithstanding, the Minnesota Trappers Association has been and continues to endeavor to reduce all problems from trapping.
Yep. Okay. We appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Thank you very much. Rachel, Mr. Sogard, if you'd like to add to that.
Yes, Minnesota Forest Zone Trappers Association. I want to say that we get the issue, that this is an emotional issue. We get that. We also get the fact that what we don't get is the fact that some of you think that we don't own dogs, but we do. And they mean as much to us as they do to you. And we will be the first to tell you that as trappers, we are not cold-blooded killers, as some would portray us. That is not the case. We try to keep our dogs well-trained and away from the traps, and we do not bring them on the trap line. We know when the season is, we cannot control people who, as stated earlier, that don't want to remain ethical, or they just forget that part that they've been taught. We have no control over that. But we try, and we try hard, I alluded earlier that there was 282,000 predators caught in the state. And I will guarantee you there wasn't one of them that was caught 5 feet in the air. We can't be bringing poles into a cornfield to set a trap for a coon. Number one, the farmer won't let us do it. And it's going to be the next thing we'll be cited for is creating a something that looks hideous and if there's an animal hanging from it. So I mean, we try hard. DNR tries hard to resolve the situation, and the opposition seems to be more of emotion, not a fact.
Well, appreciate your testimony. Sir Hoffman, would you like to add anything before we...
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sicola is not going to testify. So in closing, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say that, you know, all sides on this issue, we've had an opportunity to share views. And, you know, I still submit the Missouri example illustrates that it's fur price and not the type of trap that sets it. You can look at their data. It's pretty amazing. I like what they're doing there. And I think they do it without sacrificing family dogs. They've had zero this past year. So hunting dogs and rescue dogs, I think we in Minnesota can do the same thing too, and I'd be willing to work in conjunction to make sure that we're not affecting the trapping side of the world. But it's about saving dogs. It's about keeping dogs safe and families intent. So, you know, we're a leader on many legislative issues. You know, we heard Ed Ellinger today talk about we lead the nation in our public health. Our DNR is top dog around this whole area, and especially in the nation. We're always touted how wonderful we are with our lands and our hunting and our fishing, including a 54-inch muskie, by the way. But I want to see this Senate file 1325 be moved and laid over for possible inclusion in the Fish and Wildlife Omnibus Bill.
Well, thank you, Senator Hoffman. Without further discussion, all those in favor? Actually, we will lay over Senate file 1325 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. And I just add before we close, thank you, everybody, for your patience and your respectful dialogue today. We will be doing our best to assemble a good omnibus bill on Wednesday. And with that said, this meeting is adjourned.